Welcome to my Soul Series. Soul Series is part of Oprah and Friends, exclusively on XM Radio Channel 156. And you can listen to the entire Soul Series collection on xmradio.com/Oprah. It's uplifting, enlightening, truly powerful. Welcome to Soul Series. Welcome back to Soul Series. We're continuing our conversation from last week with Daniel Pink on his book. It's called A Whole New Mind. So you suggest that right brain aptitudes, when complemented with left-directed thinking, you say, can result in a whole new mind. And it is this whole new mind that we need to prosper in this whole new world, because we've entered, as we talked about in our last session, a conceptual age where meaning and harmony, design and purpose and play and story are going to mean more to the world than just being able to do things formulaically.
Right. You have to be able to do work that you can't send overseas, that you can't turn into a computer program, and that satisfies both the yearning for something larger than oneself and the yearning for something new. And that means that the abilities that matter most are these artistic, empathic, big-picture ones.
Are we the only people who have all of this abundance, automation, and the outsourcing ability, the ones who are having this yearning for something more? Isn't that a human characteristic?
It is. And it's a human yearning that comes out as societies get richer and richer and richer. Uh-huh. And so it hasn't reached everywhere in the world. It hasn't reached everywhere in the United States. We have a 12% poverty rate in the United States. I mean, that's morally indefensible, in my view. And so it hasn't reached everywhere, but it's reached a larger portion of people than in the history of civilization.
But what's interesting is last week we were talking about how the effects of abundance, automation, and Asia have impacted our culture in the conceptual age. And we were talking about the amount of people color TVs. Even the 12% of people who are on the poverty level, I would venture to say most of them have color TVs.
We have, that's a question of fact. We have 98% household color TV penetration in this country, in a country with a 12% poverty rate.
So I might not be able to eat, but I am watching commercials in color.
Well, I mean, in many cases, you are able to eat because of food stamps and everything like that. And our society has made something of an effort to say that we're not going to let everybody suffer.
Right.
Yeah, But they can, because color TVs are relatively inexpensive.
Okay. So last week we started out talking about right brain directed aptitudes. And you classify them in A Whole New Mind as the six senses. And we're not talking about smelling and seeing. These new senses are design, story, symphony, empathy, play, and meaning. And we talked a bit about design. Mm-hmm. How do we begin to create more design in our own lives?
Well, there are all kinds of ways to do that. One of my favorite things to do, and something that I've, again, as someone who's not good at this topic, is to carry around a design notebook. I have with me a little notebook right here. Carry around a notebook. And it's a good exercise for a week. So what you do is you take a notebook, a small notebook like the one that I'm holding here, and you say, once a day, I'm going to write down an instance of good design in an instance of bad design that I see in my midst.
And you do that just to begin to train yourself to think about it differently, right?
Precisely. And what you do is you realize everything is a product of a design decision. If you bought a cup of coffee this morning, that interaction, there's a design decision. The mug that's right here before me.
I love a big mug.
There's a design decision there. Yes. The shoes that you're wearing is a design decision. Everything in our lives has a design decision at the heart of it.
Now, what's interesting is, before reading A Whole New Mind, I always thought of design in terms of, obviously, fashion, shoes and things. But you're right. Every single thing. And then I started noticing the plates that I chose for my house, the kind of kitchen counters I chose for the knobs, the cabinets themselves, all about
design.
That's
part of it. But also there's a design decision when someone goes into an emergency room, what the configuration of that room is. There's a design decision when you go and you check in at a hotel. All these things have a design decision. Some of them are good and some of them aren't. And with design, it really is we're not trying to turn everyone into some star designer to go on, be a judge on Project Runway or something like that. What we're doing is we're trying to make people literate. And this is a great way, just a little notebook is a great way, inexpensive way to make people, help people become much more literate about design.
Okay, and start paying attention. All right. Story, which we talked a little bit about last week.
Right. I mean, story again, as we were talking last week, story is how we see the world. I mean, when...
And you're saying it's all divided up in episodes for us.
Right. Well, it's how we see the world. It's how our brains work. I mean, you know, when I come home, or when people come home from a hard day at work and their spouse asks, you know, how was your day? They don't, you know, whip out a PowerPoint presentation with a pie chart. I mean, I do, but they don't whip out a pie chart.
Yeah, you left-brainer.
You know, they say, oh, you're not going to believe it. First this happened, then that happened, then that happened. They narrate. And somehow in our kind of serious society, narration and storytelling has been banished as soft, as fake, as not serious, when in fact it's fundamental to how human beings process the world. And you see it migrating to all kinds of businesses. Companies are using the backstory of a product or service as a way to differentiate it in the marketplace.
Well, listen, this is what people learned, you know, what we saw at the Olympics. You don't just watch the Olympians perform, but it's the backstory that gets your interest and gets you to care about how they do perform. I mean, and that only happened, you know, in recent years, that the development of the story behind it. Well, obviously, I have a great affection for story because I make my living telling other people's stories.
Right.
And understand that it is only through story that you build connection. You have to tell the story so that people feel something. They only want to do something after they feel something.
Amen. I mean, that's how it works. Now, the thing is, business is growing ever so slowly to recognize that. So business leadership is in some ways about storytelling.
Yes.
So you have now business schools ever so slowly saying, ooh, we need to bring in some narrative. We need to bring in some storytelling, because if you want to lead a business or lead an organization, you have to be effective in charting out setting out a vision and having a beginning, middle, and an end, and coming up with a compelling narrative. Not as a way to deceive people, but as a way to move people, as a way to really say authentically what it is you're about.
Yes, and it's so interesting. Those of you, I know you've noticed, in the commercials on television now, so many commercials try to tell a story. Have you seen that commercial? It's about, I don't remember even it's about insurance and how Americans need more insurance. And they tell the story, and they have the story of the father who's Asian who came over, and the mother is crying, and they're telling about how they worked so hard, and then they thought they believed in the American dream, and they invested in the insurance, and then something happened, and they ended up with no insurance. All about story.
Well, I'm here. You're telling me that. I'm hearing, asking the question that they want you to ask, which is, what happened next?
You know? Yes.
And that's it. Well, you have insurance companies now, actually, and other companies, collecting their customers' stories and using that as a way to differentiate their product and service. So you have, you know, an airline like JetBlue traveling around the country with a story booth, collecting stories of how great JetBlue is, because people have airline travel is essentially a commodity. You can find out, you can compare the prices, but the way you stand out is through that effective story. You see it in fashion. People want to know increasingly now, want to know where products and services came from. Mm-hmm. So you can buy a Dole banana, Dole organic banana, that has a little sticker on it. The sticker has a number. You go to that number, go on the website, plug in that number, you can see where the bananas were grown, the kind of farm that it was on,
wow,
the farmers who grew it, because people want to know the story of how that product got from the ground to their store.
Absolutely. Symphony.
Symphony is the ability to see the big picture, connect the dots, combine disparate things into something new. It is, in many ways, kind of the signature ability. It's the best predictor of star performance in the workplace. It is, to my mind, a fundamentally artistic ability. That is, I mean, visual artists in particular are very good at seeing how the pieces come together. And I experienced this myself by trying to learn how to draw, having taken no fine arts classes in high school, no fine arts classes in college, no fine arts classes as an adult, being the well-rounded guy that I am. And I took a 5-day drawing course in New York City that allowed me to learn how to see, and how to see things symphonically, and how to see the big picture. And
I know, we see the drawing that you do before the class, where you were drawing like I do. I mean, it would be embarrassing. I think if I were like, had to do some test as an adult and have to draw myself, I could. I'm still drawing the same picture of myself that I did in third grade. Very much like yours was in the beginning. Actually, yours was better than mine. I'm worse than that. I have no sense of it. So
well,
I should do
it. You're drawing out of the... See, what happens is people have told you, You can't draw a straight line. You're no good
right.
at drawing,
yeah.
which is not right. What's happening is that people draw to the left side of the brain. There's a famous book called Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain that charted this out, and that's part of the course that I took. We draw to the left side of our brain. We draw symbols. We essentially write the face. So instead of drawing somebody's lips, we do the equivalent of writing L-I-P-S
right
there.
And, right.
and so we don't see anything.
Do that little curved line. Yes.
It's a symbol.
It's a
like
symbol.
An icon. It might as well be a computer icon.
That's right.
And so in this course, I said, the teacher said, you need to think symphonically. You need to see symphonically. Proportions, relationships, light and shadow, negative space, which is the space between space. I didn't even know there was space space.
Right.
And literally, I mean, that's talking about a transformative experience. It literally changed the way I see. When I walk into a room now, I see it fundamentally differently. I see it in a much more holistic, symphonic way.
I know. So it's 5 days. You need 5 days.
They actually have, I think I have a 1 day class too.
Wow.
Yeah, sort of a microwave version.
Okay. I'm joined by Daniel Pink. He's a classic left brain thinker who's come to recognize the powers of the right brain mind and wrote the book, A Whole New Mind, Why Right Brainers Will Rule the Future. I got that book and got it for 4,000 other kids at Stanford. How was it that you were able to come to this? How is it that you know right brainers are going to rule the future if you're not one?
Because it's actually the advantage is that I'm a left-brainer. So I look at the facts, at the evidence, and it's clear.
Oh, that's right. If you're a right-brainer, you wouldn't have even come up with this.
You would have been lollygagging around saying, oh, what a pretty picture. And, you know, and here I am.
I would have been out in woo-woo land.
Right. Yeah. I mean, here I am looking at the facts and saying, wow, there sure are a lot of people in India. Wow. Look, there are 21 million people who are doing their income taxes on TurboTax each year. That's a lot of people. What's going to happen to the accountants who do that? And you look at the facts and the evidence, and I don't think it's even close that the scales are tilting. So I, you know, as we've talked
what
about,
did you first start to notice before you even came up with this book? Obviously, you were tracking it for a while.
Well, you know, I noticed little bits of things. For instance, I wrote a book called Free Agent Nation about the rise of people working for themselves. And when I wrote that book, I traveled around the U.S. interviewing people mm-hmm. about why they decided to go out on their own. And I thought I was writing an economic book about how, you know, this is the nature of capitalism in the 21st century. I do interviews around the country. No one mentions that. They talk about, I wanted my work aligned to my purpose. I wanted to be more fully who I really was. I wanted to lead a more authentic life. I wanted to spend more time with my family. And there are so many hard-headed people talking that way. It said, so I put up a little tile up there. I noticed that a lot of the smart people I was interviewing for business stories had a background in the arts. So, wow, here's a management consultant. I get to know her a little bit better. Oh, you know, Dan, I've got a BFA in oil painting. What? Someone else. Oh, I have an MFA in theater. Oh, I've got an MFA in ceramics. You know,
wow.
You can get a degree in ceramics? What is that?
Wow.
You know, and so all these things. And I had been to India I lived in India for a while about 20 years ago. And so I started following the outsourcing story. And I saw this kind of symphony with one of the things that I'm getting better at. Take a step back from these little tiles and you look and say,
look at the bigger picture.
Whoa.
Well, what's going on here?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which brings me to play, because you said something in the book, and, you know, I'm obviously of a different generation even than you. And when you quoted, I think, a guy from USC who says that games are the new literature for this generation. And you talked about, if you were to ask every college student in this country, what movies have you seen? Maybe, you know, 50% of them have seen Casablanca, and, you know, a lot more have seen Jaws. But if you ask who's played a game, mm-hmm. you know, the Mario Brothers or whatever, 100% of them have played a game. And
right.
that if for those people in my generation to not understand the power of games, then we're completely out of it.
You know, the video games, they're good games and they're bad games. But the nature of gaming itself is quite interesting. I mean, people willingly...
There are degrees in games now.
Sure.
You can go to school and get degrees in games.
Well, there are degrees in creating video games is in many ways of this classic kind of whole-minded experience. It's about design. It's also about the left-brain programming side, but it's about how you do design it. Many of these games are story games. They're games where you follow a narrative thread through to see what happens.
Right.
It's about empathizing with the characters in that game. A lot of them are about create. You know, even the Sim game, the Sim City or the Sim Families, is about creating something. I mean, you're almost working, serving this kind of godlike role of creating something and infusing it with meaning. So games, you know, we need to take games seriously. There's some games, like I would never in a million years let my kids play Grand Theft Auto. Not in a million years. But gaming is fine. I mean, it teaches kids certain kinds of cognitive skills, and I think we need to take
it. What do you let them play?
Super Mario Brothers. Brain game. What is it called? Brain game? Brain gym? Something like that, where you answer a bunch of stupid questions. But again, I don't want my kids playing only games. Okay, I don't say you must have a 100% diet of games.
Yes.
I wouldn't want my kids doing 100% of any. I wouldn't want my kids spending all their time reading 19th century novels.
Absolutely.
I don't think that's healthy either.
Absolutely.
I think a mixed diet of these things. And I think that especially for adults, a lot of learning is taking place in the form of a game, basically a simulation, because it's a real. I mean, you know, how do you learn how to fly a plane? Do you sit in a class and take notes, or do you get into a flight simulator?
Absolutely.
I want my pilot having taken the flight simulator.
Kinda.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a way that people learn. And also in play is the importance of laughter, which is, has important physiological and psychological effects, which is why you have around the world thousands of laughter clubs where people get together each morning and laugh for no reason.
I know. I read about those, and I thought, well, God, isn't that kind of pitiful? You don't have anything really to laugh about, so you got to go to a club. You have a meeting to laugh.
That's what I said until I went.
That's what I said, yeah.
Right. Until it's like a commercial, right. What happened next? It's a story. I went in Mumbai, India, early, like 6:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
This muddy soccer field. And so this woman who's the leader of it, 40 people gathered around, and she goes, ho, ho, ha, 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 ho, ho, ha, ha, ha. Other people follow. And I'm sitting there, it's like, this is the freakiest thing I've ever seen.
Uh-huh.
And then you start doing it. And you
ho,
realize.
Ho, ha, ha, ha.
Well, that's just the warm-up exercise.
Okay, good.
The various kinds of laugh. It's like laughter yoga. But
ho, ho, ha, ha, ha. If you say that long enough, you'll start laughing?
It's not laughing like the kind of laughter. Well, it's more like that. It's not two guys go into a bar and, you know, it's not a joke. It's not about laughing at something that's funny. It's about the physicality of laughing. It's very much about sort of taking you out of your left brain and being present. It's about breathing. It's about understanding how it all works.
Ho, ho, ha, ha, ha.
That's the warm-up. And so I had the same reaction. And so I'm thinking, this is totally freaky. What am I doing? But I feel like I got to participate in this.
That's
and so
right.
I start doing it. And then you have this sort of it's almost like meditation. Meditation doesn't always work for people. I've had a hard time with meditation.
Mm-hmm.
But things that involve some kind of movement.
Ho, ho, ha, ha, ha might work.
Clapping too, right?
Yes.
Transports you, sort of takes the left brain is saying, what the heck are you doing? Why are you here this morning? What's going on?
Yes, yes.
And finally, the right brain comes over and says, just be quiet.
Uh-huh.
This is cool.
All right, moving on to empathy. I'm going to think about that whole ho, ho, ha, ha, ha. Ho, ho, ha, ha. I can see why if I did it long enough that it would at least make me smile.
Do it.
It's hard to do it and not smile.
It's impossible to do it and not smile. It's impossible to see these laughter clubs.
Ho, ho, ha, ha, ha.
Right. It's impossible to be in these laughter clubs. You just start cracking up. I mean, it's infected. I think doing it in a group is also important. It's not like meditation where you do that the whole... Right.
Yes. Well, empathy is another part of what you say we need in order to move into the conceptual right brain age. And I think I kind of got that down.
I think
but tell
so
me
too.
What you mean.
Standing in someone's shoes, feeling with their heart, seeing with their eyes. It's a fundamental human ability.
Mm-hmm.
It makes the world a better place. It's hard to outsource and hard to automate.
Yes, but if you don't have it, aren't you born with that naturally?
Yes and no.
Yes and no.
Yes and no. It's a.
You can teach empathy to your kids, can you not?
I think so. There are ranges. It's a spectrum, okay? And so you can get to the higher end of your spectrum through practice and environment and those kinds of things. And so someone who has, you know, a band of empathy that isn't very high is never going to become Mother Teresa. But all of us can move to the upper end through a whole array of things. I think starting early, as you suggest, is really important, too.
Yeah, getting your kids to step out of themselves, think of other kids, you know, during the holidays, offering not just gifts to them, but teaching them how to give gifts back, even if it's small things. Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
And then there is meaning. Oh, yeah. That's the big one that everybody's seeking. Meaning, isn't that what everybody wants? I mean, one of the things that I think I've learned is a common denominator in all of my experiences and interviews, that everybody wants to be validated. No matter who you are, even you at the end of this session will assess for yourself, you know, did I do okay?
Sure.
Was okay?
Sure.
Did what I say matter? Did
right.
you hear me? And I think that's what everybody is looking for in every aspect of their life, to have some meaning, to know that what I said meant something to you, that, first of all, you heard me and that what I said mattered. Yes.
I mean, I think ultimately that's what it is to be human at some
yes,
level.
Yes,
now, again, we didn't always have the ability necessarily, the luxury of being able to talk about that, being able to integrate that fully in our lives. When
right.
you're scraping, you know, for survival,
that's right.
it's harder to think of. It's not impossible, but it's harder to think about that. But now we can have conversations like this. People can have conversations around their dining room tables, kitchen tables about all these things. And the collective force of that is actually pretty amazing. This is why I think that baby boomers are going to do something quite spectacular. If you think about it, baby boomers started turning 60 2 years ago.
Hmm.
What happens when boomers turn 60? First, they typically say, how the heck did I get to be 60?
That's right.
Then they say, 60's not old. And it's not. And so what they do typically is they look forward 25 years and say, I got 25 years left. It sounds good. Then they look back 25 years to when they say they're 35. And they say, holy smokes, that sure happened fast. Are the next 25 years going to happen as fast?
Mm-hmm.
And if they are, what's my legacy going to be? When am I going to live my best life? What is my purpose here? What kind of imprint am I going to leave on the world? And if you think about that, this is happening in numbers that is unprecedented. You have 100, and I'm, you know, I like math. There are 100 baby boomers turning 60 every 18 minutes in this country.
Really?
For the next 16 years, this is going to go on. Imagine the collective force of that. So I think that this search for meaning spread throughout the population is one of the most important things going on in American life today.
Wow. 100? Say that again.
100 boomers turning 60 every 18 minutes.
Wow.
So think about that. Think about the conversation two 60-year-old boomers are having around the kitchen table. And then imagine that conversation going on 100 times every 18 minutes for the next 16 years.
Oh my God.
I mean, it's potentially world changing.
Yes, yeah.
I think it's ultimately a good thing. I think that some people need to sort of reawaken their sense of meaning. I think a lot of people that question that we all ask, particularly kids, why are we here? What's it all about? How did I get here? A lot of people clamp off. They don't want to deal with that. But I think inevitably, especially when people reckon with their mortality, that gets turned back on. And people are asking that kind of question.
Yeah. Okay. The keys to the kingdom are changing. We started our first session talking about that. Isn't the actual kingdom changing?
Yeah. Oops. Got to edit the book now. No, I think that the kingdom, right, who has the keys actually changes, who actually has the keys changes the kingdom. I think that the context and the rules that are in place inevitably change when certain new people are essentially in charge, or new kinds of people are in charge, or when the people who are in charge begin to develop some of these new abilities.
And what you're saying is that right-brainers and the people who have those, the greatest sense of the six senses, design and story and empathy and meaning and play, are going to be the ones who rule the future.
Yeah, they're the ones who have the abilities that we need in the economy. Those are to be the ones who are going to be flourishing. That doesn't mean that computer programmers are going to be scrubbing counters at Chick-fil-A tomorrow. But,
yeah.
but it does mean that those computer programmers, and if you talk to computer programmers, you realize this, they have to be able to do empathic work, understand the customers better, be able to move across disciplines in a symphonic way, have a design sensibility, be able to talk in narrative terms about what they're doing.
I think I know the answer to this already, but I'll just ask it. How does the integration of meaning help us rule?
Well, I mean, if you have all people out there yearning to figure out what it's all about, then those who are, I don't know how to say answering the question, but those who are convening the conversation
mm-hmm.
are the ones who are actually shaping people's experiences. And one of the things that I've realized just in general is that it's all about conversation. I would almost make that the seventh sense in a way, is that everything big happens with the conversation. It doesn't happen in a top. I'm just convinced of that as a way that things work. It happens with a few people having a conversation. They have a conversation with a few other people, and then there's sort of like a capital C conversation that eventually emerges. And so these little individual conversations end up with a capital C conversation that I think changes the country, changes the world.
Is that why you wrote the book? Because you wanted to get the conversation started?
I think that's.
Or you wanted to join the conversation?
Well, I think I wanted to get the conversation started. And okay. One of the interesting things about being a writer in a sort of hyper-connected world is that authors today get the first word, maybe, but they don't get the last word.
Yeah.
So I have my email address on the book. Uh-huh. People are responding mostly positively, but other, you know, they're finding typos. They're saying, well, wait a second, I don't know if I agree with this point or that point. And so the goal, what you want is, for me, if I think about my own personal meaning, is... For me, a great day is when I get an email from somebody who says, you know, I read this book. I've always felt like I was a little bit off. I never felt like I was taken seriously. And I read this book and I thought, I'm going to be all right. That keeps me in the writing business for another 2 weeks because it's, you know, why I in some way get up in the morning.
Well, I was in the midst of looking for CEOs and other management folks for this new network I'm creating. And I'm creating a network based on the right brain of trying to help. The whole network is designed to help people live a better life for themselves. And so as I was reading your book, I went, moving in the right direction. And it just was confirmation as well as affirmative for myself that I was moving in the right direction. I kind of believe that there's a spiritual convergence going on. Do you think this is due to the prosperity paradox?
What do you mean by convergence, spiritual convergence?
I mean that people from all walks of life in every area of their being are asking that question, are coming to the... For me, spiritual is not religion. But everybody from, you know, baby boomers to kids who are of the now generation, which they now call them, are asking that question, why am I here and what does this all mean? And I want my life to have meaning, purpose, harmony, connection, value, all those things. A spiritual convergence.
Sure. I think it's part of what it is to be human. I mean, it's encoded. I think it's encoded into our DNA. We're wondering why we're here. We're wondering what our purpose is. We're wondering why we're connected to other people.
That's right.
And it's just
and recognizing that we are connected to other people. That's part of the.
That's part of it. That's part of empathy. But it's also it also is enabled more easily in this kind of environment where you can hear from all kinds of people. Mm-hmm. You can get all kinds of ideas. People watching this webcast are not only going to be in the United States. They're going to be all over the world.
Yes, yes.
So they say, "Wow, this
hello world." Yeah.
This crazy guy from America is sort of thinking the same kind of things that I'm thinking. Maybe we are connected in some way. I think that prosperity has in some ways enabled it, but it's not so much a cause of it. It just removed a barrier. You're not, you know, spending 18 hours a day on the farm and you're not escaping from a saber-toothed tiger. You have
right.
moments of reflection
That's
where you
right.
say, what's it all about? And you realize that there's a certain...
And you're not just working from, you know, dawn to dusk, you know, just trying to get food on the table.
Right.
Absolutely.
And so I think it's ultimately a glorious thing. And there are ways, you know, and for some people it's not that comfortable of a conversation. There are things that people can do that I've encouraged them to do in the book. Because what I tried to do in the book is not only lay out this grand theory and then say... Oh, later, you're on your own. But to try to give people a whole array of tools and tips and exercises and things.
That's what's so great. At the end of every chapter, there's something to do to improve yourself.
And one of my favorite exercises, I mean, there are all kinds of great exercises in meaning, all kinds of incredible things. Like, for instance, on gratitude, Martin Seligman at the University of Pennsylvania came up with what he calls the gratitude visit, where you think of somebody in your life who is important to you but whom you haven't properly thanked. You write that person a letter expressing your thanks, and then you go there and deliver it to them in person. And people have, again, you know, I've gotten emails from readers saying, you know what, I read this and I decided to do it. And, of course, the person who is the recipient of the gratitude, you know, finds it this incredibly moving experience. And then they are triggered to think who
That's
they
right.
haven't. And so you have this kind of daisy chain of goodness. There are other things where you one of my exercises that I like is to picture yourself at 90. Picture yourself, putting yourself in the head of 90-year-old you. Looking back on your life, what are your regrets? What did you do right? What did you do wrong? Although I got a funny email from one reader saying, "Dear Mr. Pink, you know, I enjoyed your book, but I just have to take issue with your picture yourself at 90 exercise. You see, I'm 91. So
that's fantastic.
Again, I don't get the I get the first word, but not the last word.
Not the last word,
which is good.
Well, a joy talking to you.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much for exposing me and allowing me then to pass it on to our audience. And
it's all about
grads.
These contagious conversations. That's how you change the world.
That's right. That's what I believe in. Thank you, Daniel Pink. A whole new mind. I hope you enjoyed this edition of our Soul Series. These are some of my favorite conversations.
To hear more, sign up for a free 30-day XM Radio trial by going to www.xmradio.com/Oprah.